Well, as we read verse 9 of Hebrews chapter 6 on page 1065 earlier on, I wonder if you were thinking what I was thinking when I first read this passage earlier this week in preparation. What I was thinking as I read this passage, well, how is it that the writer of this letter can turn from being bringing such a strong and stern warning and a rebuke almost to the people at the beginning of chapter 6, suddenly turn in verse 9 and say, "But, beloved, we are confident of better things concerning you." But, beloved, we are confident of better things concerning you. You see, this writer, as he wrote this letter to the Hebrews, was trying to juggle two things, something that we often struggle with in the Christian life. But the writer seems to do it wonderfully well. He manages on the one hand to be able to give warning and to warn against false confidence. But at the very same time, he's able to give hope about the future. And he's able to give confidence and to give encouragement too. So many of us find it easy to do one of those things. Some will find it easy to be negative and dispirited and down and to doubt. Some people will find that very easy. Some people will find it easy to judge. But there are others who will find it very easy to sail through life without too many worries or problems or concerns about themselves, who will assume that everything's okay. Really what we need to do is both of those things and to balance the two. The writer does it for us wonderfully, and the Bible as a whole does it for us too. It both warns and encourages. So if there was a sense of warning last time around, this evening there needs to be very much a note of encouragement, a note even of confidence. So what is it that this writer is confident about? He says he's confident of better things concerning you. How is it that he's able to be confident? Well, I think in this passage she gives three answers to that question, three reasons, three things that give him confidence about these believers. Now, as I'm applying the Bible this evening and we're looking at God's Word, we need to be careful here. As the writer here writes, he's writing to this church, this Jewish church. And although these words obviously have a universal application, that's why they're part of the Bible, we can't simply sit there and say, well, because the words are in the Bible in verse 9, we are confident of better things concerning you, that necessarily applies to every individual here in whatever circumstance you're in. That would be a false way of applying the truths of the Bible to each of us. What the writer is saying here is he has three reasons why he's confident. And what we need to do really is to look at whether those reasons apply to us or not. If they do apply to us, then we can apply these words to ourselves. But if these reasons don't apply to us, then we wouldn't be justified in applying this confidence to ourselves. So what is it that makes the writer confident of these Jewish believers that they're confident of better things concerning them? Well, the first is this. The first thing that gives him confidence, it's in verses 9 through to 12. He is confident because of their changed life. He is confident because of their changed life. Let's look at verse 10, for example. He says, "We're confident. Why? For God is not unjust to forget your work, your labor of love which you have shown towards his name, in that you ministered to the saints and do minister." So verse 10 is very clear, isn't it? Because of their changed life, because of what they do, the writer has confidence in better things concerning them because of their changed life, because of what they do. And even in this verse, I think there are three different things that they do that it'll be helpful to examine in turn. But the first thing is just very simple there, is their work. They work. How can you be confident that you're a Christian? What is it that could give you confidence that you're a Christian? Well, if you work, that's one thing the writer is saying here that gives him confidence that these people are Christians. Elsewhere we find in the Bible that the Apostle Paul, for example, condemns a church, or at least some in the church, because they're lazy. And he says, if you're not willing to work, then you don't deserve these blessings and these other things that you have. A Christian is someone who works. Laziness is antithetical. That means laziness is the very opposite of what it means to be a Christian. So if you're someone who works, maybe that's something that can give you confidence that you're a Christian. If you're someone who's lazy, then that's something that should take away from any confidence that you might have. Work. So much nowadays, don't we? We find questions in the media. Are Brits really willing to do hard work? It's in the Daily Mail almost every week, isn't it? Are we really willing to do hard work? We've lost something, I think, in this nation, haven't we, of what used to be called the work ethic. I'm not by any means suggesting everybody in Britain is lazy. I know that not to be true. But it is a worry and a concern that many have, isn't it? As they look around, it seems that there are many people who expect to be given to and are not willing to give. Well, the writer here is saying that Christians can't be like that. And therefore, if you're lazy, you should lose confidence. If you work, then you should gain confidence. But we need to be careful here, don't we? There are many millions of people who work and who work extremely hard. Does that mean all these hard workers, wherever they are and whatever they believe, are Christians? Well, no, of course that's not what the writer is saying, because that's just the very start of what he says. It's not just work that matters here, but there's a particular type of work, isn't it, that he's describing. This is not just ordinary work, if I can put it like this. This is a labour of love. This is a labour of love. We can have all kinds of motivations for work, can't we? We can work through a sense of obligation. Maybe sometimes this happens to us, even in the church. There'll be a particular need. There's a gap in a ministry, and somebody's needed to fill the role. Maybe we're a Sunday school teacher short, or maybe we're some cleaning rotas put up on the wall, and we feel through a sense of obligation or duty that we ought to put our name on the list. And maybe we ought to put our name on the list, maybe. But really, that's not what gives us confidence that our name's on the list. What the writer is saying here is that they weren't just working, but this was a labour of love. This is something they love to do. They love to work. They love to serve. And now we're starting to get nearer what it means at the very heart to be a Christian, to love to serve others and to love to work. And this very much is a labour of love. But more than that, isn't it? Again, there are many people maybe who would have a labour of love. I've got friends who work in all kinds of different jobs, and they would say, I love my work, really enjoy it, it's terrific. Does that mean they're Christians? Not at all. Because it's not just a labour of love, is it? But the third thing here about this work is that they're ministering to the saints. This is a work and a labour of love that's for other Christians. This is not something that's indiscriminate. This is specifically towards God's people. And you see, again, this helps us to get to the heart of what it means to have a changed life, to be a Christian. If we're a Christian, the writer is saying, we will love one another, and because we love one another, we'll minister to the saints. And if there's a desire in our hearts to serve other Christians, particularly those whom God has placed immediately around us, but also further afield and even around the world, if there's that love in our hearts, that desire to serve, then maybe that's a sign in which we can have more confidence. But if we're not really caring about our brothers and sisters, if we don't really mind when other people are in trouble, if we're not willing to go the extra mile and willing to lend a hand and to offer prayers and support for our brothers and sisters in Christ, if we're not willing to do that, then maybe that's a sign that we should have less confidence in our conversion and in the reality of our Christian walk. There's a fourth thing here that we're told about this work, this changed life. It's there in the middle of verse 10. It's a work, it's a labour of love, it's ministered to the saints, and right in the middle, it's shown towards His name. It's shown towards His name. And really, we've now come to the heart of it, isn't it? Because these people who are here in this church, who are serving and working and doing all these different things, are not doing it to earn brownie points. They're not doing it out of obligation. They're not even doing it for their friends, good though that would be, and their brothers and sisters in Christ. But they're doing it for the Lord. They're doing it for the Lord. You see, this really, I suppose, comes to the heart of the test then. As we work and as we serve, are we doing it for the Lord? Are we asking the Lord week after week, Lord, what would you have me do? Lord, how would you have me serve? Lord, how would you have me minister? Lord, what do you want me to do? And as we're doing and carrying out the work that we do in all kinds of different ways, are we doing it to the very best of our ability? Are we doing it in the Lord's strength? Are we doing it for Him? You see, if these things are true of us, then that can give us confidence of better things in our own situation. It could give us confidence that, yes, maybe we are converted. Because if we're doing these things, it will be a demonstration of a changed life in us, because these things wouldn't have been true of us when we weren't converted. Maybe they're true of us now. Now I need to add, don't I, that there are some folk here and in many other places who would love to work and serve, find it very difficult to do so because of those personal circumstances that they're in, maybe through ill health, maybe through other reasons. And as so often in the Scripture, and as we said several times this morning, it's the heart that matters here. It's the heart that matters. It's the desire that's there. And we certainly don't want to be looking down our noses at those who, through no fault of their own, cannot serve, maybe, in the way that they would love to do so. If our heart is there, if our heart desires to serve God, and if we're praying for opportunities to be able to serve Him in whatever way He would choose for us, then that's a reason to be confident, perhaps, in the future for all that we have. Now, there may be some of you who are perhaps just getting a little nervous at this point over what I'm saying. Because here I'm saying we need to look at the work that we're doing. And the work that we do is a sign, perhaps, that we're saved. That basically is what we're saying. And that makes some of you nervous, I'm sure, because some of you have grown up all your Christian lives being told, and this is absolutely true, that it's not by works that we're saved, through faith in Jesus Christ. Not by works. So what am I saying here? Well, there's two things that I need to say. Firstly, we need to make sure that we've understood properly verse 9. We need to understand that what is given the writer confidence of better things are things that, here's the important word, accompany salvation. They're things that accompany salvation. And all the things that I've described are not things that bring salvation. These are things that accompany salvation. What the writer is saying, if you're saved, then these things will flow as a consequence. So if we can see these things, it's a sign at least, it's not a guarantee, but it's a sign at least that you have been saved, because these are the things that accompany salvation. That's what the writer is saying to us. And if we're thinking at all that these are the things that bring salvation, then we've completely missed the point. We've completely misunderstood not only this chapter of Hebrews, but we've misunderstood the entirety of the biblical message. Because the Bible is very clear that our works won't save us. Our love for other people won't save us. Our promised service for God won't save us. There are many people, Jesus says, didn't he, in the last days will say, Lord, Lord, didn't I cast out demons in your name? Depart from me, I never knew you, he says. We need to be very careful that we're looking not for signs that bring salvation, for these are not signs that bring salvation, but signs that accompany salvation, signs that we've already been saved. The other thing that we need to make sure that we've understood properly is in verses 11 and 12. Because he's confident because of their changed life, but his confidence is not unlimited. His confidence is restricted, isn't it? Because in verses 11 and 12, there's an encouragement here. Because he desires that each one of you show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope until the end. In other words, what he's saying is, I have confidence. I have some confidence. And you can have confidence too. But I want you to have full assurance of hope. How are you going to have full assurance of hope? You're going to have full assurance of hope through persevering. Through persevering. That you don't become sluggish, but you imitate those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. In other words, the writer is saying, look, this is a long-term thing. How can you be confident in your salvation? You can be confident, this is an important phrase, as you persevere. As you persevere. Now again, we need to make sure that we've understood this properly. There are some who would take a passage like this and say, well, you can only be confident in your salvation when you've persevered. In other words, when you're in heaven, you can look back and then be confident that you are saved. But that's not what the writer is saying. He's saying that as we persevere, we can be confident. So as we're persevering, as we're going along in our Christian faith, as we're progressing, as we're moving forward, in that we can be confident. We don't have to wait for some distant time in the future where we can look back and see, well, I could have been confident then because I'm persevered now. That's not what he's saying. As we persevere, as we progress, as we grow, in our growth, in our perseverance, we can be confident. And that means this, that if as a Christian we're growing and becoming closer to the Lord and loving Him more and loving others more and serving Him to the better of our ability and having a greater knowledge of Him, as we're growing, it's that very thing that helps us to have confidence when we're regressing, when we're going back, when we're backsliding, when we're falling away, there our assurance and confidence needs to go. Now our confidence is based not necessarily on where we are, but also in the direction in which we're going. And we can have the same assurance of hope as we progress and as we grow and as we serve Jesus Christ. Now, what does all this mean for us then? If I'm saying that we can be confident because of a changed life, does that mean we're confident in ourselves? Surely that's not what the Bible's saying, is it? It's not what the writer is saying here. He's not saying he's confident in these believers, but he's confident that he can see God working in these believers. It's an important difference, isn't there? He's not confident in them, but he's confident that he can see God working in them. And that's what we're looking for in our own lives. We're not looking, am I able to do this? Am I good at that? Have I been doing this and this and this by myself? That's not what we're looking for. What we're looking for is evidence of God working in us. So as we see ourselves doing things that we know in our own strength we couldn't do, there's evidence. As we see ourselves taking risks that if it wasn't for God being with us, we'd never take, it's evidence. As we see ourselves dealing with difficult situations that on our own we couldn't deal with, that's evidence of God working in us. Where we see ourselves with our lives changing in ways that nobody else expected or imagines, that's evidence of God working in us. That's what we're looking for, evidence of God working in us. And we know that's the case, because not only is the writer confident because of their changed life, but there's two other things that he's going to say as well, and it's the first of those other things that we're going to look at next. So he's confident because of their changed life, but secondly, verses 13 through to 18, he's confident because of the promises of God. He's confident because of the promises of God. And you can see there, can't you, in verse 13, that he talks about God making a promise to Abraham. You may wonder, where's Abraham suddenly come from? Well, if you've been listening to the messages week by week in Hebrews, you'll know that the writer of Hebrews is a big fan of Abraham, and he mentions Abraham often. And what he's doing here is he's taking us back to an Old Testament story about Abraham, and he's helping us to see how Abraham's story can relate to our own. What happened to Abraham was in Genesis chapter 12, God made Abraham a promise. It's a very special and important promise in the Bible. It's in the early verses of Genesis chapter 12. And he gives this promise and he asks Abram to leave his country and his family and to go to a land that I will show you. Here's the promise. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. Make your name great and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. It's a wonderful promise of God to Abram back there in Genesis chapter 12. So here's this promise that he gives. But that isn't the promise that's mentioned in Hebrews chapter 6. That's another promise that comes later in Genesis chapter 22. Let's look at that very briefly. Genesis chapter 22. Here's the second promise. And this is Genesis chapter 22 and verse 16. God says, "By myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. Blessing, I will bless you. And multiplying, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." Because you have obeyed my voice. Now it's a wonderful illustration that the writer gives now of Hebrews, of Abraham. It's a perfect illustration really for what he wants to say. Because what he wants to say is that we can be confident because of the promises of God. That's his main point. It's not just because of our changed life, but our also confidence comes from the promises of God. How does all this fit together? Well, back in Hebrews chapter 6, it's helpful maybe to keep your finger in Genesis, but back in Hebrews chapter 6, he says this about Abraham. After he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise. For men indeed swear by the greater. An oath for confirmation is for them an end of all disputes. Just stop there to explain verse 16. We don't really get very much into oaths nowadays, do we? Except maybe in court, where we'll be asked to swear. We have contracts nowadays, don't we? And we sign and the like. But in the day when this was written, very often in an illiterate society, or maybe when deals needed to be done quickly and there wasn't time, you would swear an oath. And you would swear an oath not just by yourself, but you would invoke maybe the Lord, or if you weren't a Christian, some other God, and that's how you would swear. And you would swear this oath in the name of a God. Now when the Lord swears an oath to Abraham, he obviously can't do that. He can't swear by anybody greater than himself, like more normal people would, because he is the greatest. So he says that he swears by himself. That's what Genesis chapter 22 tells us. And what the writer is saying here, if we swear this oath, well, that's as good as it gets. That's the end of the matter. That's a firm, absolute promise. You can't go back on that. And here is the Lord swearing by the greatest of all, by himself. And he therefore, verse 17, is determined to show more abundantly to the heirs of the promise the immutability of his counsel. Now the immutability, if you've got a more modern translation, means something that doesn't change. Immutable. Doesn't change. Can't be moved. His counsel, his purpose, his will, that is, what God has decided. So what the writer here is saying to the Hebrews is that he wants to show even more clearly, even more abundantly, to the heirs of the promise, that's to Abraham's descendants, he wants to show that this hasn't changed and it won't change. The promise that he gave to Abraham still stands, and he wants to declare it to the heirs of the promise. That's what he's saying here in verse 17. So in verse 18, now there's two things the writer says, two immutable things, two unchangeable things in which it's impossible for God to lie. God can't lie, you see. That's why the two things are unchangeable. And that gives us, hope you're following verse 18, I know it's a bit of a mouthful, it gives us strong consolation, strong encouragement. So in other words, what the writer is saying to us, look, we've got two things now. We've got the first promise in Genesis chapter 12. That was great, and God can't lie about that. That's all we need in a sense. That's a promise that's unchangeable, that's given by somebody who cannot lie. Surely that's enough. But God is so gracious, he didn't just give Abraham that promise, but in chapter 22, he restated the promise in even more clearer terms. And he swore this oath by himself. So now we've not only got one immutable, unchangeable thing, now we've got two immutable, unchangeable things in which God cannot lie. And surely that's a great encouragement. Well, you may be thinking that's a great encouragement for Abraham,
But what's all that got to do with us? And what's that got to do with the Hebrew church here? Why was what happened to Abraham a great encouragement to us? Well, the Jews who the writer was addressing here would know the answer to that question, because they loved and understood their Old Testament. That's what they'd grown up with. And they knew that the promise that God had given to Abraham was the promise actually that was flowing through Abraham's descendants even into the church today. And that promise that God gave to Abraham is being fulfilled as men and women and boys and girls come to the Lord Jesus Christ and are saved. And the promise that is given to Abraham of the land and of the family of the generations is being fulfilled as people become Christians. And Abraham's descendants are multiplying as people are added to the church. And Abraham's descendants are multiplying such that back in Genesis 22, they're being multiplied as the stars of the heaven and as the sand on the seashore. So are his descendants are. That's us today. We're the children of Abraham in this very real sense. And through that, all nations of the earth shall be blessed, he says. Well, that's being fulfilled as the gospel is going out to every nation. Men and women and boys and girls, literally all around the world, are hearing good news about Jesus Christ. Why? Because God is fulfilling his promise to Abraham. And he wants us to understand it. And he wants us to look back at the Old Testament, and he wants us to be confident because of the promises of God, and he wants us to understand that there are loads of promises in the Old Testament, and they are being fulfilled.
I think, too, he wants us to understand the context of which this promise was reiterated in Genesis 22, because there's something even more here for us, something even more wonderful. Because the promise in Genesis chapter 12 was that through Abraham and through his descendants all this blessing would come. And many of you will know that Abraham got to a very great age and he had no offspring, no children. And God promised that even in his old age a child would come. Even his own wife couldn't believe it. But Abraham did believe in God. He believed this child would come, and so indeed he was born. And in Genesis chapter 22, where this promise is reiterated, it comes just after a time when Abraham has been tested by God. Abraham's been asked to bring this child. And Abraham's been asked, and one of the commentators I read on this passage said, surely this is the hardest and strangest of all the things God has ever asked throughout history. That may be an exaggeration, but if it is, it's not much of one. Because God says to Abraham that he wanted him to sacrifice his son, to kill his son on an altar. This son that Abraham had had in his old age, this son through whom all these promises were to be fulfilled, and God now says to Abraham, I want you to take this child's life. What would you do in that situation? Well, Abraham went to obey. That was his reaction. He was to obey. And he tied up his son and he got him ready to be offered, and he took out the knife. And only at the very last moment did God withdraw Abraham's hand and return, as it were, Isaac to him. Now, as the writer of Hebrews meditates on that later on in chapter 11 of Hebrews, do you remember what he says? He says that Abraham had faith. Where was his faith? He tells him that his faith there is in verse 11. By faith Sarah received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, from one man, and him as good as dead, that's Abraham as old he was born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. And then verse 17, by faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called. Here's the important verse, verse 19 of Hebrews 11, concluding that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. Do you see Abraham's great strength, great faith?
You see, he knew that God had promised that through Isaac the blessing would come and that the multitude would come. He knew that, and he believed it absolutely with all his heart. And because he believed it, he therefore believed that if God took Isaac, God would have to return him and bring him back from the dead. God would have to do that in order to fulfill his promises. So even though every other person on the planet, it would seem almost, would have thought, no, this can't be possible, this can't be true, this can't be like this, Abraham believed it was possible. And Abraham believed that God would raise Isaac from the dead because he believed the promise that came. And so, the writer tells us, he did metaphorically, as it were, receive Isaac back from the dead. And it's after that that the promise is reiterated in even stronger terms. And I think what the writer to the Hebrews wants us to understand is this, that right throughout the whole of the Bible, God has been promising blessing and eternal life in heaven for those who trust and for those who believe. But there was a time when one, as it were, was offered on an altar. One who was offered by his father, willingly. And it had been promised in the Old Testament, hadn't it, that blessing would come through this son. But this time, God's hand was not withdrawn. This time, where the knife came down, the wrath of God was poured out on his son, who died and hung there in the place of every man and woman and boy and girl who ever put their trust in him. And on the third day, of course, the one who was buried in the tomb rose from the dead. And there in his resurrection, as we received him back to life, not metaphorically, but literally, the promise is restated in even bolder and even grander terms. So that now when God, as it were, swears his oath, he's doing it in a greater way than even he was able to do in the Old Testament. And we, as it were, as God's great and precious oath. And we can see, can't we, not just the promises of God, but we can see, as they could in Abraham, God's promises being fulfilled in Jesus Christ. And he wants us to understand that we've had the promise. We've had God acting on the promise. And now we've had the even stronger restatement of the promise. So we've seen Jesus Christ be raised from the dead, ascend into heaven. And that brings us on to our third point, you see. Because the first was that we could be confident of their changed life. The second, we could be confident of the promises of God. The third now, that we can be confident because of the finished work of Jesus Christ. Hebrews chapter 6, verses 19 and 20. Confident because of the finished work of Christ. This hope we have, he says, as an anchor of the soul, sure and steadfast, which enters the presence behind the veil, where the forerunner has entered for us, even Jesus, having become high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. You see, what the writer is reminding us here is it's not just God's promises, great though they are, unchangeable though they are, sure they though are, even though there are multitudes of them, it's not just God's promises, but it's actually what Jesus Christ has done that gives us confidence and hope. And this is where it all rests, you see, because God promised that Jesus would do something. And what Jesus has done is what changes our lives. Everything comes back to this. Everything comes back to the cross. And here we see it's this that is the anchor of our soul. It's this that is sure and steadfast. And he says in verse 19 that this hope, as it were, enters the presence behind the veil. Many of you will know that what the writer is referring to here is the temple or the tabernacle. And in the center of the temple or tabernacle is the Holy of Holies, this very holy place that is so holy that ordinary people can never enter it. Priests can never enter it. Only the high priest is able to enter the Holy of Holies when he's gone through a particular ceremony, and only then once a year. It's an incredibly holy place. It's said to be the dwelling place of God. And it was hidden, therefore, by what's sometimes called a curtain or a veil, a partition maybe would be a better description. We're not to think of a flimsy curtain, but a solid partition. And our hope, the writer is saying, goes into the Holy of Holies. It goes behind the veil into the very presence of God. And the Holy of Holies was, if I can put it like this, heaven on earth as the place where God dwells. And this is to remind us that our hope there can reach and extend into heaven. It's this anchor to the soul. Here's what the writer's saying. If we're converted, if we have faith, if we have saving faith in Jesus Christ, if we know what it is to believe the promises of God and to experience the changed life, then our anchor, as it were, rests not in this earth, not in ourselves, but in heaven itself. Some of you know that a few months ago, Cher and I went on a boating holiday in the Norfolk Broads, and one of the things that we had to learn about was anchors. And our anchor was with us all the time. But when our anchor was on the boat, it was no good at all, was it? The anchor there resting on the bow of the boat, it's not going to do anything any good. We had three anchors, but while each of the anchors was just on the boat, they were completely worthless and useless. What had to happen was that the anchor had to be in the bank or on the bottom of the river in order for it to hold. And this is what the writer's saying here, that our anchor is not in ourselves. We're not confident in ourselves. It's not that we anchor ourselves to ourselves. That's worthless. But we're anchored to something that is sure and steadfast. The solid bank, or whatever it may be. Our anchor is in heaven. More than that. Our anchor, it's not only that our anchor is in heaven, but here, verse 20, we have something else. We have a forerunner who has entered for us, even Jesus. Here's what the writer is saying. How can we be confident? How can we believe that what God said will happen is going to happen? How can we believe that heaven is real? How can we believe that we can get there? How can we believe that God will raise us from the dead? How? Because He's done it already for Jesus Christ. Because Jesus Christ has risen from the dead. Jesus Christ is in heaven. Jesus Christ has His resurrection body. He's enjoying all the fruits of heaven. He's the forerunner who has entered for us. That's what Jesus has done. He's blazed the trail. He's shown the way. He's coming back in order to bring us with Him. This is the great glory. It's the finished work of Jesus Christ on the cross. And that is where our confidence is anchored, the writer's saying. But he's saying even more than that. And with this we'll close. He's telling us at the end of verse 20 that Jesus Christ not only provides an anchor in heaven, He's not only a forerunner for us, but He has become high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. He'll have much more to say about Melchizedek. Don't worry too much about that this evening. But we can think instead about the high priesthood of Jesus Christ. You remember, only the high priest could enter the Holy of Holies. Only the high priest was allowed there in the presence of God. And Jesus now has become high priest. He's become high priest not for a term. They used to serve a term, often for life, and then that was the end. They need a new high priest. That's not Jesus. He's high priest forever. And what's the writer telling us? He's telling us that our hope is not just for now. Our hope is not just for a generation or a decade or even a millennia. But he's telling us that our hope is hope forever if it's rooted in Jesus Christ. And there is no other religion, and there is nothing on this earth that can give us hope like that. There are insurance companies that can insure our lives and it will be good for our loved ones. But who would insure us for the life to come? Who would look after us there? Only Jesus Christ. And here the writer is saying, to go right back to the beginning, how can we be confident in our salvation? Well, if we have a changed life and we can see the evidence of God working in us, then we understand that the reason that has happened is because of the promises of God from way back at the beginning of the Bible right through to now. And because of the finished work of Christ, we can know that those things that God has said He would do, He has done. And Jesus Christ has proved it, demonstrated it to us. It means now that there's no need for us to doubt. As I close, There are some who doubt because they ought to doubt, because there's not much evidence of a changed life. They don't really believe the promises of God, and they're not sure that Jesus has finished his work, and they think they have to add to it. And if that's the reason you doubt this evening, then I urge you to look again at these verses. I urge you to go to Jesus Christ and to confess the sin of unbelief, to ask him to forgive you and to grant you faith that you too might believe in him. There are others who are not sure, and they ought to be sure. There are people maybe whose lives have been changed, who do believe the promises of God, and who do believe in the finished work of Jesus Christ. And yet somehow, maybe through character, maybe through other reasons, aren't able to be sure. What does the writer say to such folk? He would want to say to them, I'm sure, beloved, we are confident of better things to you. And you see, part of the joy of being part of a fellowship of a church is if there were folk like this in the church that the writer was addressing here, they may have doubted themselves, but because others were able to put an arm around the shoulder and to say, brother, beloved, we are confident of better things concerning you. What a lift. What an encouragement. What a hope that was able to be brought to those who really could be confident. So if there are those who are struggling with assurance, who really have got a changed life, and really do believe in the promises of God, and really are confident in the finished work of Christ, I want to say to you, beloved, we are confident of better things concerning you. Yes, things that accompany salvation. For God is not unjust, and what he has said he will do, he will do.